We just said, hey, you need to recognize when your mental condition works against you, when your delivery breaks down, and what happens in your delivery. After Carmona's bullpen meltdowns, the Indians sent the rookie right-hander to AAA Buffalo to start games, not finish them. They called him back to Cleveland as a starter, then sent him to the Dominican Winter League to start some more, the better to develop the greater stamina needed by a starting pitcher after spending most of 2006 in the bullpen. In 2007, in the seventh year of Carmona's holistic development, mental, physical, hell, even dental, the Indians' little $10,000 investment had become a workhorse major league starter. Carmona threw 215 innings. He finished second in the league in wins, 19, and second in ERA, 3.06. Trying to hit his power sinker was like trying to hit a bowling ball. Nobody threw more double play grounders, 32. He had by far the best ground ball to fly ball ratio in the league, 3.28. The Indians had themselves a young pitching star. The Indians had won the lottery. When the kid from Santo Domingo took the ball for the ninth inning of Game 2 against New York, the game tied, the midges swirling madly, the Yankees sending Johnny Damon, Derek Jeter, and Bobby Abreu to the plate, with Alex Rodriguez waiting in case any of them reached base, Carmona's task would test every bit of that holistic development. No Cleveland pitcher this young ever had thrown nine innings in a postseason game. No starting pitcher had lasted nine innings against this formidable Yankees lineup all year. Carmona pulled his cap down a little lower, ignored the midges, and went to work with the calm purposefulness of a diamond cutter. Damon grounded out. Jeter struck out. Abreu reached first base on an infield single to shortstop, then promptly swiped second base on the next pitch. The must-have game for the Yankees had come down to this. Rodriguez, the most expensive player in baseball, against Carmona, the erstwhile $10,000 kid, with the potential winning run at second base. Rodriguez, for all of his 156 runs batted in during the regular season, was in need of some serious holistic postseason help himself. He was 0-for-5 in the series, without getting the ball out of the infield, and had four hits in his previous 49 postseason at-bats with the Yankees, including 27 consecutive at-bats without a hit on the road. Rodriguez did see nine pitches, but it ended badly for him. Carmona, with his 113th of the night, buzzed a ferocious sinker under the hands of a swinging Rodriguez for strike three. When Carmona marched into the Cleveland dugout, Indians trainers were amazed at what they saw. His face and neck were covered with hundreds of midges. Not once had he taken a peeved swat at any of them. It was as if they were never there. The midges left a short time later, their 45-minute window to wreak havoc on the Yankees and help close the curtain on the Torrey era having expired. Rivera did provide two shutout innings, but as soon as Torrey had to go to anybody else in the bullpen, and in this case it was Luis Vizcaino, the game was over. Vizcaino walked the leadoff hitter of the 11th inning, the preamble to an eventual game-winning single by Travis Hafner. The Yankees were one game away from elimination. The same could be said for Torrey. Steinbrenner made sure the world knew it, too. On the morning of Game 3, Steinbrenner, out of nowhere, was quoted in the Bergen Record explaining that Torrey was gone with one more loss. "His job is on the line," Steinbrenner said. "I think we're paying him a lot of money. He's the highest-paid manager in baseball, so I don't think we'd take him back if we didn't win this series." The bluster would have been normal procedure for Steinbrenner 10, even 5 years earlier. But in 2007? It was shocking. Steinbrenner's handlers had kept him away from the press all year. He communicated with the media only through carefully worded statements from his public relations representative. When writer Franz Litz, assigned by Portfolio magazine to write a piece on the Yankees' owner, breached the protective wall around Steinbrenner by visiting him that summer unannounced at his Tampa home, the description that emerged of the boss was a pathetic one. Steinbrenner was portrayed as barely lucid, mumbling and repeating himself. Steinbrenner was well enough to make only 3 games in New York all year before this series. And now, with his team on the brink of elimination, he had suddenly found the old gusto? Ian O'Connor, a columnist for the Bergen Record, had called Steinbrenner at his place in the Regency Hotel. It was a play taken from an old Yankees beat writer playbook. Call Steinbrenner when the team is playing poorly, and you just might get yourself a headline if the boss decides to pop off. In the 1980s, the beat writers used to call Steinbrenner Mr. Tunes, because getting outrageous quotes from him was as easy as dropping a quarter into a jukebox and making your selection. Many of the quotes were as familiar as hit records, straight from the Steinbrenner catalog. But this was 2007, and Steinbrenner's declining health had rendered him little more than a figurehead who was barely seen or heard from. Indeed, not more than a week later, the Yankees would announce that Steinbrenner officially was no longer actively running the team, but would serve as a kind of patriarch to the operations. There was no answer on Steinbrenner's phone. O'Connor kept calling. No answer, another call. Then suddenly, Steinbrenner picked up the phone. He answered questions. O'Connor decided that Steinbrenner sounded lucid enough for the quotes to have merit. He had his headline. It was big news. Torrey found out about Steinbrenner's winner be gone edict on his drive into Yankee Stadium for Game 3. He always did hate having his job security become a public issue around his players, but now it had become the issue. At his scheduled pregame news conference, Torrey took 13 questions. 9 of them were about his job status and Steinbrenner's comments. "You don't always get used to it," Torrey said in response to one question about his reaction to Steinbrenner's comments. "But you understand if you want to work here, and certainly there's a great deal of upside to working here, that you have to understand that there are certain things that you have to deal with. You know, that's pretty much where I am." Cashman sought out Torrey behind the batting cage during batting practice. "I'm sorry," Cashman said. "I had nothing to do with it." "I'm pissed about the timing of it," Torrey said. "We don't need this." Said Torrey, "At that point I knew I wasn't coming back, even if we won." All things considered, Torrey did a fairly good job concealing his hurt and disappointment. The urgency of the Yankees' plight demanded his attention. It was up to Roger Clemens to save the franchise and the manager. Clemens was 45 years old, had not pitched in 20 days, and, with his body betraying him, was staring at the possibility that this finally could be the last game he pitched in the big leagues, especially considering at that moment the 2 tons of dirt on him sitting on the desk of baseball's independent steroids investigator George Mitchell. Even if the Yankees somehow managed to survive that game, the decision by Torrey and Cashman to have Wang pitch 2 of the first 4 games looked far more suspect now that the Indians had hammered Wang in Game 1. As the Yankees took batting practice before Game 3, Messina walked over to Wang in the Yankee Stadium outfield. "Can you pitch tomorrow?" Messina asked him. "No, you pitch tomorrow," Wang said. "I didn't ask you that," Messina said. "I said, can you pitch tomorrow?" Yeah, I'm okay," Wang said. Said Messina, "He really didn't give me an answer. He was just kind of confused about the question. And then, 15 minutes later, they told him that he was going to pitch the next day. On 3 days' rest. I knew he was getting worn down. It was a long year. He had thrown a lot of innings. I knew he was worn down. The point is, I know Joe would have been scrutinized to death if he had pitched me in Game 4 and I got beat. I still think I would have given us the best chance to win that day because I was rested. Wang wasn't. Wang had been beat up. I'd had success against the Indians, and it was a home game. Whether that would have made a difference or not in that game, I don't know. Just personally, I felt good about facing them." To even get to a Game 4, the Yankees needed to survive a start from Clemens, who was a physical wreck, with hamstring and elbow woes, but who basically called his own shots. There was a game September 3rd against Seattle, for instance, when Torrey thought Clemens might consider not making the start because of his elbow trouble. Torrey had Messina standing by as an emergency starter. He left it up to Clemens. "Roger insisted he could pitch," Torrey said. "I must have asked him 10 times. I said, you know, you don't have to pitch this game. And I know he's bullshitting me because he's bullshitting himself. He has this meeting with himself, and he convinces himself that he can do this. He wills himself. So in getting that same point across to me, I'm still looking at this from the more rational side, so I'm still a little skeptical. It's like David Cohn. You go to David Cohn and ask him, can you get this guy out? And he goes, yeah, I'll get him out. He may have to pull a gun to do it, but whichever way he has to do it, he'll get him out. It gets to the point with certain guys, guys you've been around and trust, you know when they make that commitment, they're going to do it. It may not be pretty, but they're going to get it done. So with Roger, you want to give him the responsibility, but you're sitting there thinking, I don't know why I let him do this. Then again, if I didn't let him do it, I'd be sitting there thinking, I wonder if he could have done it. It's one of those things where you second-guess yourself, but you know there was no other way to do it. In that September 3rd game, Clemens lasted only 4 innings before the elbow pain forced him out. He gave up 5 runs, and the Yankees lost to the Mariners 7-1. Now Torrey was rolling the dice on a creaky Clemens again, only this time with their season and the manager's job riding on it. There was no hesitation, Torrey said. Clemens never made it out of the 3rd inning against the Indians. He needed to throw 59 pitches just to get 7 outs. His hamstring fairly groaned in protestation when he tried to field a soft ground ball near the mound in the 2nd inning. His body was giving out. After that episode, he told Torrey, Skip, I'll give you a signal if I can't do it. Of course, a failing Clemens, still too proud, never gave the signal. He was laboring obviously when, already down 2-0, he walked the leadoff batter of the 3rd inning. Torrey told catcher Jorge Posada to talk to Clemens. Let me get this guy, Clemens said, referring to the next batter, Victor Martinez. Somehow Clemens struck out Martinez, but Posada looked into the dugout at Torrey and shook his head, signaling that Clemens was done. It was the last batter Clemens would ever face. Torrey removed Clemens, replacing him with Phil Hughes, who would allow the 3rd run to score. Clemens walked off for the final time, limping. He walked down the dugout steps gingerly, needing to hold a handrail to steady himself. His great career was over. It was pretty obvious he had to come out, Torrey said. You could tell just by watching him that he couldn't get the ball to do what he wanted it to do. He wasn't locating it. He always talks when he comes into the dugout, and he was talking that night about not being able to get the ball to behave the way it's supposed to. When you look back, you say, well, it was his age. What are you going to do? The body just doesn't heal as quickly as you would want it to, or used to. But no second thoughts. When you get to the postseason, a lot of it is emotions. It sort of overrides ability a lot of times. Down 3-0, the Yankees rallied to win the game 8-4. Hughes pitched 3 2/3 innings of shutout ball. The offense awoke. Still, the front office wasn't happy about Torrey using Chamberlain for 2 innings. The Yankees were leading 5-3 heading into their at-bat in the 6th inning when Chamberlain began throwing with the instructions that he would pitch the 7th to protect the 2-run lead. The Yankees tacked on 3 runs in their at-bat. Chamberlain was already warming by then, so the best course of action was to get him in the game rather than sit him down and risk having to get him up again if Cleveland threatened. Chamberlain cruised through the 7th inning in order on 16 pitches. Now, Torrey had a choice. Did he pull Chamberlain to keep him strong for Game 4? If he did that, then he would have given the 8th inning of a must-win game to Kyle Farnsworth. And if Farnsworth wobbled even just a bit, Torrey would have to send Rivera into the game in the 8th inning, which would limit his availability for Game 4. Torrey was not prepared to take that kind of gamble, not with Farnsworth, especially not in an elimination game. I was trying to do whatever I could to stay away from Mariano, to have him for 2 innings the next day, Torrey said. Chamberlain got through the 7th with a low pitch count. Now my choice is to go with someone else in the 8th, but if I don't get a clean inning, then I've got to get Mariano up, which was the one thing I was trying to avoid. I guess I never really had enough trust in everybody else down there to think that getting 3 outs in that spot is so simple. Chamberlain stumbled in the 8th. He gave up a run while needing 22 pitches to get through it. Rivera breezed through the 9th inning in order, needing only 10 pitches. Torrey's plan had worked. He won the game and got to a Game 4, with his best pitcher Rivera fresh and available for 2 innings. Chamberlain, freed from the Jabba rules, still could come back with 1 inning. If the Yankees could win the first 6 innings of Game 4, Torrey felt Chamberlain and Rivera, barring another biblical-like plague, could get the final 9 outs to bring the Yankees to a Game 5, when each would be refreshed by a day of rest from an off day after Game 4. Some members of the front office, though, saw that Chamberlain had thrown 38 pitches in an 8-4 game and shook their heads. Once again, after the game, Torrey was forced to talk about his job status. The only thing I try to do, Torrey said at his press conference, is allow my players to roll the dice out there and play, because every time we go to postseason, there's nothing that's going to satisfy anybody unless you win the World Series. And that's very difficult. Those are very difficult situations for the players to play under. I understand the requirements here, but the players are human beings, and it's not machinery here. Even though they get paid a lot of money, it's still blood that runs through their veins. And my job is to try to get them to be the players they are by, you know, allowing them to understand that the best effort you can give is all you can do. His words seemed for the consumption of Cashman, Steinbrenner, and Steinbrenner's cabinet, as much as for the assembled media in front of him. It had been another long day in a long season. The shocking Steinbrenner win-or-be-gone mandate, which was more proof his bosses no longer trusted him, the focus on his job security, the sight of Clemens hobbling off the mound for what this time really did look like the end to his career. To the very end, even victory exacted a toll. It was the 1,249th win with the Yankees for Torrey, including postseason play, over 12 seasons. It would be the last. The last game of the Torrey era began with a wish, a sort of last request, which seemed fitting because Torrey delivered it in the maze of narrow hallways in the basement of Yankee Stadium, which at times like these had the feel of catacombs winding darkly toward the gallows. Torrey was walking to his usual pregame news conference before Game 4 with Phyllis Merridge, Senior Vice President of Club Relations for Major League Baseball. "I hope we win the World Series this year," Torrey told her, "so I can tell them they can shove this job up their ass." There was no hiding the hurt. 3 years of growing distrust from his employers had culminated with Steinbrenner taking a shot at him out of the blue, and with his team down to its last breath, no less. Torrey didn't know O'Connor was telling people he had kept dialing Steinbrenner on his own accord in search of a story. "It sounded like somebody set it up," Torrey said, referencing people close to Steinbrenner, especially knowing where George was at that time with his health. "People couldn't get to George all year. It looked like it had other fingerprints on it. Of course, I was probably gun-shy at that point anyway. I said what I said before Game 4 because I didn't want to come back with that whole attitude of distrust in place. It was all stuff that seemed contrived. I can't stand living like that, where people are looking for ways to trick you. If you don't want somebody around, just tell them." The end held little drama. It was 87 degrees when the game began, the hottest October 3rd in the recorded history of New York. Wang, pitching on short rest, was even worse than he was in Game 1. The first batter hit a home run. The third batter singled, and the fifth batter singled, accounting for a 2-0 Cleveland lead. In the second inning, the leadoff batter singled, and so did the next batter. Wang hit the next batter with a pitch. Torrey had seen enough. Wang had faced 9 batters and retired only 3 of them. He left the bases loaded for Mike Messina, who allowed 2 of those runners to score before pitching out of the inning. Wang, already tagged for a playoff record tying 8 earned runs in Game 1, became only the 10th starting pitcher in postseason history to lose an elimination game while failing to get more than 3 outs. The gamble to pitch Wang twice in 4 games blew up on Torrey and Cashman. Messina, who had wanted the ball and who had described Wang as worn down heading into that start, pitched decently in relief, allowing 2 runs over 4 2/3 innings. "They stayed off pitches that other teams swing at," Torrey said about how the Indians battered Wang. "I think he maybe tried too hard, tried to do too much." Said Boa, "You can have the greatest manager in the world, but if your ace gets rocked in 2 playoff games and it's best out of 5, you're in trouble. You're in deep shit. That's what happened. Now, I still say that if we win that one game, the Java game with the Bugs, we beat them." The Yankees had an early chance to recover from Wang's miserable start. They put runners at first and second with 1 out in the first inning, whereupon Alex Rodriguez whiffed on 3 pitches from soft-tossing journeyman pitcher Paul Byrd. Rodriguez did hit a home run later, with nobody on base, in the 7th inning, and the Yankees losing 6-2. The Yankees batted .228 in the series. They did hit 7 home runs, but 6 of them came with nobody on base. Abreu, Jeter, Giambi, and Rodriguez, 4 of the 9 highest-paid players in the game, batted a combined .238. Rodriguez was, again, particularly dreadful, especially in the big spots, failing to drive in a single run but for his cosmetic solo home run in Game 4. The team with the $61 million payroll dominated the team with the $190 million payroll. The team with 13 past and future All-Stars crushed the team with 26 past and future All-Stars. Was it a fluke? Another casualty of the randomness of a short series? No. It was an affirmation that the rest of baseball, fortified by increased revenues and smarter business practices, had chipped away at the competitive advantage the Yankees had enjoyed because of resources alone, and the Indians were at the front of that wave. Cleveland, for instance, cut the gap on the Yankees with their attention to detail on medical and health issues. In 2007, the Indians lost only 324 player days to the disabled list, the fewest in the league and second fewest in baseball, while paying a total of just $4.3 million to players who were physically unable to play. Over the previous three seasons, the Indians ranked number one in baseball in fewest days lost to the disabled list. They were the best at keeping their players on the field, a huge factor for lower payroll teams who could not afford the depth to withstand injuries. The Yankees, meanwhile, were abysmal when it came to age and injuries. They flushed away $22.22 million on players who couldn't play, or almost 12% of their bloated payroll. They lost 1,081 player days to the disabled list, more than three times as many days as had the Indians. Over the previous three seasons, the Yankees ranked 23rd in baseball in days lost to the disabled list, a trend that would continue in 2008. The 2007 division series was the continuation of a downward spiral for the Yankees. The more they tried to recapture the magic of the dynasty, the more money they spent on acquiring players from outside the organization, most of whom did not bring a winning pedigree, and the more they focused on patching holes with veterans from winter to winter, the more they lost sight of the importance of a farm system. And the more they needed those veterans, particularly when it came to pitching, the fewer good options were available, as the rest of baseball, armed with new revenues and new intelligence to help evaluate player value, held on to their prime assets rather than lose them to big spenders such as the Yankees. That new paradigm was particularly evident in October when the Yankees no longer had any power pitchers in their prime to match up against the better teams in the league. In their dynasty, the Yankees could match up their number four starter, be it a young Andy Pettit or Orlando Hernandez or David Cohn or Roger Clemens, against an opponent's number one starter and still feel good about the matchup. No matter how their rotation fell, the Yankees never were disadvantaged. But in their downward spiral, the Yankees kept sending to the mound broken-down pitchers, or pitchers who could not throw the ball past hitters with any consistency. In Torrey's final 17 postseason games, his starters were 2-8 with a 6.36 ERA, while averaging only 4 2/3 innings and 3 strikeouts per start. In the last six games in which the Yankees faced playoff elimination, Torrey's starting pitchers were a broken-down Kevin Brown, seven-game winner Sean Chacon, a broken-down Mike Mussina, a broken-down Jarrett Wright, a broken-down Roger Clemens, and sinkerball specialist Qianming Wang on short rest. The demise of the Yankees was a thick stew of multiple ingredients, but the main one, the one that gave it its most distinctive flavor, was the inability to develop or acquire starting pitchers with prime stuff that could make hitters swing and miss. Strikeouts are a quick and easy barometer of the quality of a pitcher's stuff. The most damning statistic to quickly explain what happened to the Yankees is that in the 7 years after the Yankees last won the World Series, their starting pitchers, without exception, were worse every year at striking out batters than they had been the year before, while generally throwing fewer and fewer innings, shifting more of the workload to the bullpen. Every year, without fail, they suffered through a diminution of pure stuff. They were a franchise leaking oil. Here is the steady plummet in their starting pitchers' strikeouts. In 2001, a record of 64-48, with an ERA of 4.34 in 974 and a third innings, and 7.79 strikeouts per nine innings. In 2002, a record of 79-41, ERA of 4.34 in 1,024 and two-thirds innings pitched, and 7.32 strikeouts per nine innings. In 2003, a record of 83-42, ERA of 4.02 in 1,066 innings, and 6.91 strikeouts per nine innings. In 2004, a record of 70-46, ERA of 4.82 in 942 and a third innings pitched, and 6.55 strikeouts per nine innings. In 2005, a record of 70-51 with an ERA of 4.59 in 965 and a third innings pitched, and 6.11 strikeouts per nine innings pitched. In 2006, a record of 74-42 with an ERA of 4.54 in 933 and two-thirds innings pitched, and 5.84 strikeouts per nine innings. And in 2007, a record of 65-47, an ERA of 4.57 in 921 innings pitched, and 5.61 strikeouts per nine innings pitched. "You need that dominant number one starter," Jason Giambi said. "That's what you need, especially in a short series. You need to change the tide, quick. Because if you're down, even 0-2, if you have that big guy to come back and win that big one, now it's up for grabs. You need guys who can strike guys out. You need big punch-outs. You're not going to play those 9-8 games anymore in the postseason. You need to win 3-2, 2-1, and be able to match up against the other team's big guys. You need big outs, big punch-outs. Guy on second base, two outs, you can't have the ball put in play where it's putting pressure on you every inning. You need to get out of that inning sometimes without having to make a play." And really, in that regard, we had a role reversal with the Red Sox. Until they got Schilling to go with Pedro, we could beat them. Then once they got that extra power guy, that's what kind of turned the table for them. Then they went and got Beckett. That's where they turned the tide on us. From 2001 through 2007, the best young strikeout pitchers never reached the free agent market to become available to the Yankees, such as Mark Pryor, Kerry Wood, Johan Santana, Jake Peavy, Carlos Zambrano, C.C. Sabathia, and Brandon Webb. The swap of Ted Lilly, a gutsy strikeout pitcher if not an ace, for Jeff Weaver, a sinker baller with questionable makeup, was a critical mistake. And when the Yankees did acquire a hard thrower in his prime, Javier Vasquez, they somehow saw the worst of him and punted him after just 1 year. What made their search for a power pitcher all the more desperate was that their draft and player development system went bankrupt when it came to homegrown pitchers. In the 13 drafts in between taking Andy Pettitte in 1990 and Phil Hughes in 2004, the Yankees drafted 397 pitchers. Not one of them made a significant contribution to the Yankees' rotation. Not one. No sleeper pick came through, no top pick panned out. No middle-round pick developed that one pitch or made that key adjustment to be a good starting pitcher for the Yankees. The odds were staggering that the Yankees could not hit on somebody, even by dumb luck. But that's what happened. With more resources to plow into scouting and development than every other franchise, the Yankees went 0 for 397 over more than a decade of pitching bankruptcy. With each year the Yankees spiraled further downward from their last World Series championship, the more frustration and distrust bubbled from within the organization, with the manager taking the brunt of it. And while all of this was happening, the team's most dynamic asset, George Steinbrenner, was fading into a sad personal twilight, physically unable to provide leadership when the franchise most needed it. "Lead, follow, or get the hell out of the way," read the sign that for 3 decades sat on his desk at Yankee Stadium. The charismatic man could no longer lead or follow, so he was consigned to getting the hell out of the way, which created an enormous void and, at best, uncertainty in the power structure of the team. With their advantage in resources, the Yankees would be virtually unbeatable if they ran a clean, efficient, and self-sustaining organization. When other teams smelled chaos there, however, they knew they had a chance. The Yankees had rivals and enemies throughout baseball, but their greatest threat came from within. "We're counting on there being dysfunction in other places that have greater resources," said Shapiro, the Indians' general manager. "And is that going to make the difference?" "No. But it's 100 different little things that together hopefully will." By Game 4 of the American League Division Series, the Indians had turned 100 different little things into an advantage over the Yankees. They had the better team, and it was there for all to see on that weirdly warm night at Yankee Stadium. With one out in the top of the eighth inning, only 6 outs left in his tenure as Yankees manager, Joe Torre walked to the mound to make his last pitching change, removing Jose Veras and bringing in Mariano Rivera for the last time. As Torrey walked off the mound toward the dugout, something spontaneous and touching happened. The crowd started chanting his name in the way that had become the official Yankee Stadium salute, the way the fans chanted for Paul O'Neill at the end of World Series Game 5, knowing how it would be O'Neill's last game at the stadium. Joe Torrey, Joe Torrey, Joe Torrey. In the back row of the press box, a Yankees official, one of the voices who had Steinbrenner's ear, heard the outpouring of support for Torrey from Yankees fans, and, with a stunned look, could muster only two words. Holy shit. This was not good for the voices. They didn't like the fact that Torrey was liked. It was 11:38 p.m. when the end came. Jorge Posada swung and missed at a pitch from Cleveland closer Joe Borowski for the final out of a 6-4 Yankees loss. It was the last pitch of the last postseason game ever played at Yankee Stadium. Borzello, the bullpen catcher who had been there through the entire Torrey era, took that long walk from the bullpen across that great big outfield, across the infield and toward the Yankees' dugout on the first base side. He made sure he looked up and gazed around the cathedral one last time. "I knew this was it," Borzello said. "I knew Joe wasn't coming back. And then I saw Paul O'Neill, who was standing there by the dugout, working for the Yes Network, and he goes, 'Tough series, Borzy.' I looked at him, and I realized how much things had changed. And I almost wanted to cry." As the Yankees trudged into the clubhouse, Torrey called them together one last time under his command. He spoke briefly with little emotion and never addressed his own situation. "Guys, sometimes you can try your best, give it everything that you can, and it's just not supposed to happen," Torrey said. "We just weren't good enough. I'm proud of what you did. You dug yourselves out of a hole and learned what it takes to be a team." Torrey made his way through the catacombs to the interview room for one last news conference. Of course, he was asked what he thought would happen to him next. "This has been a great 12 years, he said. "Whatever the hell happens from here on out, I mean, I'll look back on these 12 years with great, great pleasure, based on the fact that I'm a kid who had never been to the World Series, other than watching my brother play in the '50s, and paying for tickets otherwise. To have been in 6 World Series and going to postseason, I can tell you one thing. It never gets old. It never gets old. It's exciting. The 12 years just felt like they were 10 minutes long, to be honest with you." The news conference was being broadcast on the stadium monitors. Torrey's coaching staff was gathered in his office, standing there in front of the television, listening to the manager say his goodbyes. They knew he was gone. When he left the news conference, he returned to the clubhouse, where players were speaking in whispers, trading hugs and handshakes. The room had the pall of a funeral. Cashman walked into Torrey's office. They had been together for 12 years, but they were strangers in that room. Cashman couldn't find the right words. It was as if they were standing on the same train platform, and Cashman knew Torrey was on the next train out of town, but that he was staying. "He looked uncomfortable," Torrey said. "He didn't know what to say. He later admitted to me that he was uncomfortable. I don't even know what he said." One by one, most of the players stopped by to say thanks or goodbye to Torrey. Pettit, Clemens, Jeter, Messina, Chamberlain. Chamberlain was crying when he came in to say goodbye to Torrey. Asked if he assumed Torrey would not be back, Messina said, "Oh yes. Those of us that are older, we knew they weren't treating him very well. I talked to him. It was only about 15 seconds. Everybody was talking to him, especially the guys that had been with him for a long time." Ever the optimist, Jeter thought his manager still was coming back in 2008. Rodriguez never did come by to see his manager. He would be named the most valuable player 1 month later, prompting a congratulatory message from Torrey. Rodriguez never called him back. Rodriguez was one of the last players to emerge from the back rooms of the clubhouse to make himself available to the media. He was already showered and dressed when he stood at his locker and answered questions without any emotion. "At the end of the day, my job is to help the team win a championship," Rodriguez said. "I have failed at that. Whatever blame you want to put on me is fair." Rodriguez had the contractual right to opt out of his contract. The Yankees had declared very publicly on more than one occasion that should he elect to tear up his contract and seek a new one through free agency, they would not so much as negotiate with him. One Yankees official said no less than an hour after the Game 4 loss that they figured it would take $300 million to get Rodriguez signed to a new deal, and they already had developed a backup plan. Trade for pitcher Johan Santana of the Twins. The Yankees could take half of the money it would have taken to keep A-Rod and give it to Santana, the left-handed ace who, at 28 years old and as a three-time strikeout champion, who had whiffed more than one batter per inning over the length of his career, was exactly the kind of pitcher the Yankees had needed for years. Rodriguez left Yankee Stadium that night, not knowing if he would wear the Yankees uniform ever again. Torrey was much more certain. He showered, dressed, and left his office in the clubhouse, believing this would be the final time he would do so as manager of the New York Yankees. He did not look back. 16. The End. "Do you want me to manage?" Joe Torre began the meeting with that simple question. They were sitting in the Legends Field office of George Steinbrenner. There was a time, and as recently as only 24 months earlier, when Torre could look the boss in the eye and propose that question, and he would get an answer that would let him know exactly where he stood. But Steinbrenner wasn't the boss anymore. He was the aging patriarch of a 7-man tribunal. His family members and front office lieutenants went through the exercise of playing to tradition and formality anyway. Steinbrenner sat at his desk, and the others sat at the table that ran lengthwise away from his desk. There was Torrey, of course, and Steinbrenner's two sons, Hank and Hal, his son-in-law, Felix Lopez, team president Randy Levine, chief operating officer Lon Trost, and general manager Brian Cashman, who sat behind Torrey's right shoulder. On October 18, 2007, 10 days after the Yankees lost the division series to Cleveland, 10 days of public waiting for Steinbrenner to follow through on his Game 3 warning that Torrey would not be back in the wake of defeat. The question Torrey proposed was now the domain of the 7 other people in the room. Steinbrenner sat slumped in his chair with dark glasses covering most of his face. Occasionally he would take them off, put them back on, take them off, put them back on. He contributed virtually nothing to the meeting, except for occasionally simply repeating the last sentence of what someone in the room had just said. The strange, sad element to the setting was that the men were surrounded by old reminders of Steinbrenner's vitality and iron will to win. Steinbrenner always had envisioned himself as a cross between a Hemingway character and a military leader, a man's man who gave no quarter, who boasted of bringing a football mentality to baseball, and the room reflected his pride in such obstinance. On the table behind him, there was a picture of him as a halfback on the 1951 Williams College football team, reaching for a pass while a defensive back from Ball State elbows him in the back. Steinbrenner liked to tell people that he did not catch the ball, that the Ball State defensive back knocked me flat on my ass. The man, he wanted you to know, could take a hit. There was a picture of the horse Comanche. Why Comanche? Steinbrenner liked the idea that the horse was the only survivor of Custer's last stand. He admired survivors. There was also a picture of General George S. Patton, given to him by a member of Patton's staff. It was not your typical military portrait. Patton is seen pissing into the Rhine. There was a picture of his grandfather, George M. Steinbrenner I, who married a girl from Germany, and who started the Kinsman shipping line of freighters, which carried ore and grain over the Great Lakes. Of course, there were the aphorisms with which Steinbrenner literally liked to surround himself. Some of them were captured in frames, and some of them were kept under the glass top of his desk. "The measure of a man is the way he bears up under misfortune," Plutarch. "And do not go where the path may lead. Go instead where there is no path and leave a trail," Ralph Waldo Emerson. "You can't lead the cavalry if you can't sit in the saddle. The speed of the leader determines the rate of the pack." And his favorite, "I am wounded, but I am not slain. I shall lay me down and rest a while, and then I will rise and fight again." Anonymous. Times were different now. For Steinbrenner, it was time to rest, not time to fight. This was his office, but it was not his meeting. It was not his decision alone anymore. The meeting was Torrey's idea. Hank, Hal, Felix, Levine, Trost, and Cashman had kicked around the idea of what to do about Torrey for the better part of a week. Do they offer him another contract, and if so, for how long and for how much money? Do they even want him back at all? While they deliberated, Torrey told Cashman he wanted to meet with the group face to face. It wasn't much different from how he managed. You look somebody in the eye and rely on direct honesty, rather than leaks and second-hand information. The six Yankee lieutenants thought it was a good idea. By then, they had decided that they would offer Torrey nothing more than one guaranteed year. The day before the meeting, as the two sides finalized arrangements for the meeting, Cashman broke the news to Torrey that he probably would not do any better than a one-year offer. "They only want to give you 1 year," Cashman told him over the phone. "What about a second year?" Torrey asked. "I don't think they're going to offer you that." "Cash, I have an idea. What about a 2-year contract? It doesn't even really matter what the money is. 2 years, and if I get fired in the first year, the second year is guaranteed. But if I get fired after the first year, I don't get the full amount of the second year, just a buyout. The money doesn't matter. I mean, as long as it's not just something ridiculous. It's not about the money. It's the second year." Torrey had just gone through the toughest year of his career, what with the leaks, the sniping, the constant talk about getting fired, and the feeling that people within his own organization were rooting against him. He was worn out by all of that. There was no way he was going to go through another season like that. And there was one scenario that would have set the table for exactly that kind of season all over again, working under a 1-year contract. That scenario would stamp him a lame duck all over again, with the leaks and sniping and managerial death watch starting up again upon the first 3-game losing streak in April. All Torrey wanted was to manage one more season in relative calm, and the second year on a contract would help provide that kind of stability. The second year was nothing but an insurance policy. He planned to retire after that one season anyway. "I couldn't do it on a 1-year deal," Torrey said. "I couldn't go through what was the worst year of my professional life all over again. I couldn't put my family through it again. I couldn't put my coaches through that again. All I wanted was 1 year where nobody is questioning me about how you're going to lose your job." On October 18th, Torrey, Cashman, and Trost boarded a private jet in Westchester, New York, for the flight to Tampa. He had told his coaches that he wasn't sure what was going to happen. "I knew at the time I thought it was going to be 60-40 that he wouldn't come back," third base coach Larry Boa said. "You know, Joe kept everything pretty quiet. He said, 'I'll get in touch with you guys.' Selfishly, I wanted him to come back because I loved coaching there, but he had to do what he had to do. Coming back on a 1-year deal would not be fair to him or the players, because he would have been gone quickly, no question. For a guy with what he's done for the city and that team, that's the one thing I thought was very unfair. I don't think he was treated the right way. I mean, I think Joe earned the right to go out on his own, and he should have earned the right to open that new stadium. At least they should have said, 'Okay, this year we'll give you, and for the new stadium you have an option if you want to stay or not, or go upstairs and be an advisor.' I really thought that was going to happen because of what Joe meant to the city, the players that played there, and to the organization. And it didn't happen like that. It turned out to be an ugly ending." On the plane ride to Tampa, Cashman repeated his warning to Torrey about the length of the contract, again choosing a pronoun carefully as if to distance himself from what was about to go down. "I don't think they're going to go more than 1 year," Cashman said. "What are you going to do then?" "I don't know," Torrey said. "I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm just going to go in there." Torrey was putting his faith in the power of personal communication, anticipating that a face-to-face meeting with the lieutenants would bring about an honest negotiation. He held out hope that there was a way to manage the Yankees in 2008 without his head in a noose from the first day of spring training. The first thing he needed to know was if they really wanted him in the first place. "Do you want me to manage?" Levine and Hal told him that yes, they wanted him back, and it was a unanimous decision by everyone in the room. Hal said they had decided on an offer. A 1-year contract at $5 million, a 33% pay cut from his 2007 salary. Hal told him, "I want you to manage because you're good with young players." Torrey wondered why, if that were the case, they were offering only 1 year. If the Yankees reached the postseason, Torrey would get another $1 million. He would get another $1 million if the Yankees reached the League Championship Series, and another $1 million if they reached the World Series. Levine classified the bonus money as incentives, implying at the meeting, and later to reporters, that Torrey needed to be motivated. "It's important to motivate people," Levine would later tell reporters, "as most people in everyday life have to be, based on performance."
Motivate?
The 2007 Yankees had come back from the sixth-worst 50-game start in franchise history to make the playoffs. They had used 14 different starting pitchers. No Yankees team except the wartime 1946 team ever needed more. And yet they still won 94 games. They roared back from a losing record as late as July 7th to play 675 baseball down the stretch, 52-25. Three-fifths of their original rotation was a disaster. Kei Igawa and Carl Pavano combined for 3 wins, and Mike Messina endured the worst season of his career. And yet they won the third most games in all of baseball. Did Torrey help accomplish all of that and then suddenly lose his motivation during, of all times, the playoffs? Or did the Yankees' exit have something to do with their ace throwing 2 of the worst games in postseason history and a freakish attack of Lake Erie midges? Torrey would later tell reporters he considered the incentives an insult. In doing so, he was not referring to the idea of incentives or the money itself, but rather to the thinking of the Yankees' executives that he needed such a carrot to be motivated. "I don't need motivation to do what I do," he told the Yankees' executives at the meeting. "You have to understand that." Said Torrey, "I've always had a $1 million bonus for winning the World Series. In fact, in my last contract, when we put it together, Steve Swindell and myself, we had different stages, if you win, win, win. That's the way it was when I took over initially, even in my first year, that you got so much for getting to different levels. I said then, let's admit it, the only thing that's worthwhile is the World Series. The only bonus I want you to put in there is the World Series." As much as Torrey was bothered by the idea that he needed incentives to be motivated, what really stopped him was the term of the contract. Sure, maybe even the 7 executives in the room did want him back, but they wanted him back only in the exact compromised position in which he had managed the 2007 season, with a noose around his neck and a trap door below his feet. They wanted him to manage the Yankees only from an exposed position. There was no way Torrey was coming back under those conditions again. Not when he knew it meant being put in the crosshairs of being fired and undermined from day one. The 7 executives, meanwhile, would consider no other arrangement but that one. Going back to the first question I asked, "Do you want me to manage?" the answer they gave me really wasn't honest, Torrey said. They said they wanted me to manage. If they wanted me to manage, we would have found a way to get it done. And that was never the case, because there was never any movement. Negotiation is something that takes place between 2 sides. That didn't happen. It was either take it or leave it. And my feeling was that only because I was here so long that they felt they were obligated to make an offer. Torrey calmly tried to make a case for himself. For instance, he pointed out that over the course of his tenure, attendance at Yankee Stadium had skyrocketed 90%. The Yankees ranked in the middle of the pack in attendance in Torrey's first year, in 1996, 7th of 14 teams with 2.2 million fans. In 2007, the Yankees ranked first, with 4.2 million fans. He talked about ad revenues he brought to the Yankees himself from companies that wanted to be associated with one of the most successful managers in modern history. Under Torrey, of course, the Yankees were a postseason guarantee, a perfect 12-for-12 in postseason appearances with peanuts in half of those years and world championships in a third of them. The promise of October baseball helped drive season ticket sales and offered another month of revenues when most ballparks were dark. And even when Torrey's teams did not win the World Series in the 7-year drought, the Yankees were far and away the best team in baseball. In that 2001 through 2007 drought, the Yankees were at least 37 wins better than every other team in baseball. None of it meant anything to the 7 other people in the room. Not, anyway, in terms of even considering a second year. "The reason I went there to Tampa," Torrey said, "is I wanted to see somebody face to face, and I wanted to see if any of these points I brought up made any sense. I mean, where the attendance was when I first got there and where it was now, the revenues they've made since then, Maybe all this stuff would somehow negate some of the fact that they felt I was overpaid and overstayed. Overpaid and overstayed. And then nobody had the guts to just say, "Get out." That was the worst part. There would be no negotiations. When Cashman was asked later by reporters why the Yankees refused to negotiate, he said, "It's just complicated, given the dollars." But dollars had nothing to do with it. Torrey would even tell reporters later that the $5 million salary was generous. He wasn't asking to negotiate dollars. He was asking to negotiate 1 year of some security and peace. The Yankees would have none of it. And when the seven executives made it clear to him that theirs was a take-it-or-leave-it offer, Torrey understood the greatest pillar of his management style had been destroyed. The trust was gone. He knew his employers did not trust him. For a man who made trust the single most important ingredient of championship teams, trust among teammates, trust from those players in the honesty and integrity of the manager and staff, he could not continue without it. It became an easy decision. He told the seven executives he could not accept their offer. "Yeah, I was leaving a lot of money on the table," Torrey said, "but I didn't give a shit, because I knew what I went through the year before, sitting behind that desk every day and dreading coming to the ballpark. It would have been the same thing. I mean, if I could go right from my house to the dugout, it would have been wonderful. But that other shit I had to put up with, I didn't want any more of that. And there was no price tag I could put on that. I couldn't do it for all the money in the world for 1 year like that. And really, I only wanted to manage one more year, because I wanted to manage that 1 year in peace." So that was it. The 12-year Torrey era had come to a non-negotiable end. Torrey's run as manager of the New York Yankees ended with a meeting that took little more than 10 minutes. As Torrey got up from his seat in Steinbrenner's office, Hal Steinbrenner said to him, "The door's always open. You can always work for the Yes Network." Torrey was too stunned to speak, caught between bemusement and anger. Did the boss's son really just dangle the consolation of working for the Yankees-run regional television network after the Yankees refused to negotiate with the second-winningest manager in franchise history? Wow, Torrey thought. They really don't get it. Torrey shook the hands of everybody in the room, starting with George. The old man took his dark glasses off and said, "Good luck, Joe." "Thanks again, boss," Torrey said. Felix was the only one who walked out of the room with Torrey toward the elevators in the reception area of the third-floor offices. But then Cashman appeared. "Joe, Lon and I won't be flying back with you," Cashman said. "We'll be staying here." Seeing Cashman suddenly reminded Torrey of something. That 2-year proposal he made to Cashman over the phone in advance of the meeting, the one with the buyout in it. The offer never had been discussed in Steinbrenner's office. Torrey figured Cashman already had presented it to the other executives, and he was curious as to what happened to the proposal. "Cash," Torrey said, "they had no interest in that buyout proposal, the one I gave you over the phone?" Cashman looked at Torrey oddly, as if this was something new. I really didn't understand it," Cashman said. "Remind me, what was it again?" 2-year contract, whatever the number. If they fire me during the first year, they pay me both years. If they fire me after the first year, they pay me some reduced amount we can talk about." "I'll see." Cashman walked back into Steinbrenner's office. Torrey was incredulous. "I was thinking, well, shit. He never told them," Torrey said. They had spent 12 years together, Cashman first as the assistant to General Manager Bob Watson, and then as the general manager of 3 consecutive world championship teams with Torrey as the manager. Torrey had presented Cashman with the lineup card from the clinching game of the 1998 World Series, the one in which those Yankees established themselves as one of the greatest teams of all time, with a record 125 wins, postseason included. Torrey and Cashman had shared dinners and champagne and laughs and arguments. 12 years. It was an eternity in baseball for an executive and a manager to work together for that long. But at the moment when Torrey was searching for some way to save his job, and when he turned to Cashman in his moment of need, Cashman did not so much as pass on to his bosses a proposal from Torrey. A simple one, too. One that was not at all difficult to understand. 12 years together, and it ends like this. Come to think of it, Tori thought, Cashman had said nothing during the entire meeting. Cashman was the general manager who had convinced Steinbrenner after the 2005 season to put in writing that he would have control over all baseball operations. The manager is a fairly important part of baseball operations, and when the future employment of the manager was being discussed, how was it that the empowered general manager had nothing at all to say? Cash was sitting right over my right shoulder, Tori said, and never uttered a sound the whole meeting. Cashman, for his part, said simply, it was Joe's meeting. Only much later did Tori start to put the picture together of what had happened to his working relationship with Cashman. The personal fallout they had in 2006 spring training, Cashman's conversion to the religion of statistics, his disregard for bringing back Bernie Williams, his submission of odd lineup suggestions based on stats, his lack of regard for Ron Guidry as a pitching coach, his detachment from the responsibility they were making on an offer to Tori, his failure to offer any comment or support in the meeting to decide Tori's future, his failure to personally relay to the Steinbrenners Tori's proposal to find a way to reach an agreement. Where could Tori find support in the end? Steve Swindell, thanks to one DUI charge, had been run out of the organization and the Steinbrenner family. George Steinbrenner was not fit enough to deal directly with Tori himself. And now Cashman had retreated to silence with Tori's job on the line. The allies of Joe Tori had dwindled to zero. I thought Cash was an ally. I really did, Tori said. You know, we had some differences on coaches and the usefulness of the coaches. I know he didn't think much of Guidry. And Zimmer. You know, Zimmer could not trust Cash, and I disagreed with Zimmer vehemently for the longest time. Then, you know, you start thinking about things. I don't want to say it's a weakness, but I like to believe that I want to trust people. And I do trust people until I'm proven wrong. And it's not going to keep me from trusting somebody else tomorrow, because it's the only way I can do my job, is to be that guy. Tori still held out faint hope that the 2-year proposal could be the pathway to an agreement. He waited by the elevators. It was a last-ditch effort by me to remind them, "Does this make any sense for us to get together?" Tori said. There weren't any cross words. I didn't say things to them in anger or anything. It was more like, "If that's the way you want it, that's the way it is." It was just trying to move a little bit and give them an offer that maybe they could live with. I just wanted to make sure before I did walk away from this thing that I gave them every opportunity to keep me. Not more than 30 seconds after Cashman left Tori at the reception area, Cashman came walking back to him. It took less than a minute for the Steinbrenners, Levine, and Trost to wholly reject the idea. No, they have no interest in doing that, Cashman told Tori. No interest. Rejected in less than a minute. That was it. It was done. The Tory era officially was finished. He stepped into the elevator and pushed the button for the ground floor. A strong feeling washed over him. Relief, Tory said. A feeling of relief. The relief came from knowing it was a very easy decision. He flew back home alone. What follows is a conversation with the authors.
Joe, how did it feel to look back on 12 years managing the Yankees, especially while you're still managing, this time with the Dodgers?
It was very strange because, when people ask me, have asked me in the past, you know, look what you've accomplished. You know, look at winning 4 World Series, going to 6 World Series and winning 4 of them. I've never really took time to admire because I always felt while I was still doing it, I just didn't want to, you know, look back and say, wow, look what I did. And then all of a sudden, you know, stop working at things. So I figured I had plenty of time to look back, after I was completely out of baseball, but, to look back to, you know, to go through for the Yankee years, it was goosebump time for me. It was really strange, but it really stirred up a lot of memories, a lot of emotion, And I found it actually a lot of fun. It was a little bit of a roller coaster ride, but I found it to be a lot of fun.
Well, I think one thing that comes across is the respect for Derek Jeter and the friendship that you two share. Do you remain in contact with Derek and any of the other Yankees?
I do. You know, several of the Yankees. I have my safe at home banquet every winter, and I always stay in touch with the guys who spent a lot of time in the New York area because, you know, our dinner is in New York, and we always ask them to take part in it, and they've always said yes. And it's, you know, it's the Jeter, and it's Posada, Rivera, Bernie Williams. Of course, this past year we honored the 98 team, so we brought in the David Wellses and of course, Andy Pettit and you know, guys who were part of that 98 club. But I do stay in touch. Jeter, probably more than anybody else. Once my daughter Andrea taught me how to text, you know, he seems to like to do that best of all. But he's the one I probably have the closest relationship with. And I think that just comes from, obviously, his being the captain, the guy I used to go to a lot to try to get a sense of the clubhouse. But it's a nice relationship, and I certainly expect it to go on.
Well, another one of your former players, Joe Girardi, is now the Yankees manager. What was that like, having one of your former players actually replace you as manager of the Yankees?
Well, that's why it became a little bizarre when people kept saying, are you happy that the Yankees aren't doing well? And, you know, here you are trying to win the division out west. You know, a guy like Joe Girardi, not only who played for me, but he also coached for me. And then to have him be the manager who took my job, but took the job after I had it, I had a root for him. I mean, Joe Girardi, he was one of the first acquisitions that the Yankees made after I was named manager, and it was based on the fact that I felt we needed, if our strength was going to be pitching, we needed a good catcher, and I always admired what Joe did, watching him with the Cubs and, of course, with the Colorado Rockies. He looked like a take-charge guy, and he was every bit that type of person. And a good fit for our winning ball clubs. There was no question. And just to watch him do this, the only thing it tells me is that I'm getting older. You know, because all of a sudden you find guys who were players and playing for you and playing for other teams, and now all of a sudden they're managing in the big leagues. That all of a sudden starts dating me, and I don't necessarily have a problem with it, except that time passes very quickly.
Joe, did you have any apprehensions or difficulty in doing the book?
I do. I always have apprehensions because in order for a book to be interesting, you have to tell people something they don't know. And a lot of times when you're writing a book or even doing an article, that you don't want to violate any kind of trust that you really earned over the years. So I have to be very careful. Even sometimes when it's a funny anecdote, you certainly don't want to be funny at somebody else's expense without them being aware of it. So I was very conscious of, first off, everything that went on in the 12 years and, you know, the fact that you wrote the book to me is... It helps me a great deal because I have a great deal of trust in your ability and you as a person. So it was a lot easier than it probably would have been with trying to do it with somebody else.
Well, I appreciate that. Now I'm going to put you on the spot. 12 years managing the Yankees, lots of championships, lots of wins. If you look back on it, what stands out for you as your favorite memory as the manager of the Yankees?
Well, you can't get away from how exhilarating it is to be better than the Red Sox. I think that's the one thing over the years. I didn't think it was a big deal when I first started managing the Yankees until you realized that the Yankee-Red Sox rivalry was something that was unlike any other in all the sports, probably. And probably the even though Game 6 of the 96 World Series will always be etched in my memory bank as very special and being the culmination of my first, you know, the celebration of my first World Series, the 2003 Aaron Boone home run in Game 7 of the Championship Series to beat the Red Sox after trailing most of the game is probably my, the one exciting memory of my time with the Yankees.
One more question, Joe. After all these years, how does a New York guy like you like Los Angeles?
Well, it's laid back. And, you know, I think after my last 3 years in New York where I felt that I either had to get out of the business or find out if I could do it somewhere else or if it was just the fact that it was time for me to move on, I was curious. And when the Dodgers expressed interest, I decided to let's see if managing can be fun again. And coming out to L.A. certainly was a lot different, not only the other part, the other side of the country, but the other league, and just, you know, and dealing with a lot of young players again. But I was glad I did it because it all of a sudden put the attention back on baseball, and I always find a great deal of exhilaration and satisfaction from the game itself, and that's one thing I think I lost the last couple of years in New York with everything else that was going on around me.
Joe Torre, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tommy.
This is Michael Kramer. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Yankee Years by Joe Torre and Tom Verducci. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated. Text copyright 2009 by Anjoli Incorporated and Tom Verducci. Production copyright 2009, Books on Tape.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.